From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Hospital administrators in Arizona are warning that they are in danger of running out of room for coronavirus patients. The state has seen one of the worst spikes in hospitalizations in the country, and the new wave comes 4 weeks after the state ended its stay-at-home order. The mayor of Phoenix, Kate Gallego, joins us now. Mayor, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And there are public health experts who are looking at Arizona and saying that it might be time to consider a second stay-at-home order if this keeps up. Is that where you're headed, and would you be in favor of something like that?
I am very concerned about what's happening in Arizona right now. I live in Maricopa County, and in our community, 27% of the cases we've had the entire time we've been fighting COVID have been in the last week. I am trying to send in a message that we need to take this incredibly seriously and that we're not done fighting it yet. The governor has preempted mayors from doing business restrictions right now, but we're trying to do everything we can. We do need to have additional protections. I'm very worried when I see full nightclubs. We know transmission can occur in that situation, and so I would like to see us do more to protect our community.
Let's hear from your governor, Doug Ducey, who lifted the stay-at-home order back on May 15th. Some people thought that might have been too soon. Here he is yesterday responding to the rise in cases there.
This virus is not going away, so this virus is something we need to learn to live with, and we need to make sure that we are protecting the most vulnerable in our society.
Mayor, can you explain what is going on with the attitude in Arizona? You mentioned their nightclubs are full. Do people just feel there's no need to social distance, that the pandemic is over, that there's no need for masks in public? I mean, what's going on?
So overall polling shows that people are cautious and they are worried about what is the appropriate steps. But we do see very concerning situations where people just went back to normal. I understand that it has been difficult and that everyone wishes we could go back to the world of February. I hope that people understand that with some very reasonable protections, such as wearing masks and washing hands and social distancing, that we can save lives and slow the spread.
But one of the issues I know you have, and you alluded to this, is that in some ways your hands are tied because you, as the mayor of Phoenix, cannot call for restrictions that are tougher than the guidelines that have been set down by the governor. Tell me more about how that affects you and the city that you're trying to keep safe.
The protections we originally put in place started with mayors doing executive orders and, for example, moving restaurants to takeout to try to push social distancing. We saw the curve decline and cases spread less quickly as a result of that. Then the governor put in place executive orders that said mayors could not take those type of steps. If I had the opportunity to do so, I would closely follow the Centers for Disease Control guidelines, which would have us opening in stages and would not have allowed us to go straight to packed nightclubs with no masks.
I want to ask you about another big issue that this country is facing. Your police department said this week that officers can no longer use chokeholds. Now, of course, many departments across the country are making similar announcements. But why didn't Phoenix PD do this years ago?
We have been working on this issue. There's no issue that I've spent more time on than building trust between police and our community during my 14 months as mayor. For the first time ever in our city, we passed a civilian oversight board and an Office of Accountability and Transparency. We've fully deployed body cameras to all of our officers who work with the community. We are trying to be responsive and build that trust. We want to be self-reflective and do better.
Do you support taking money out of the police department's budget?
Phoenix is literally the fastest growing city in the United States. I want to make sure that we have a safe place to call home for everyone. And I believe that a police department is an essential part of that. I do want to take a hard look at what services we ask our police officers to provide. I'm concerned that in Arizona, we don't fund mental health adequately, and then the police department becomes the service provider of last resort. So we are going to continue to look at the role of public safety and policing in our community.
I just want to make sure I understand your position here, though, because it sounds like you're saying maybe in those ways you would be adding money to the budget. I just want to be clear, because obviously the country is talking about how to fund police. I just want to know whether the mayor would support Phoenix police having money taken away from the police department's budget.
I want to modernize policing. I believe we still need a strong department as long as there is domestic violence and human trafficking and armed shootings in our community. We need police officers to respond. I think we are asking police officers to solve too many problems in our community, but we still need them for many of the great dangers we face.
Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
There will soon be an updated definition for racism in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. This action comes after Kennedy Mitchum, a recent college graduate, emailed editors frustrated over the dictionary's current definition of racism. And Kennedy Mitchum joins us now from St. Louis, Missouri. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So Merriam-Webster Dictionary has long served as the gatekeeper of the English lexicon. The current definition in the dictionary defines racism as, quote, a belief that race is the primary determinant of human rights and capabilities, and that racial differences produce an inherent superiority of a particular race. And you say that definition is inaccurate. Say more.
There's a lot of systemic elements to racism. And with everything going on, I think that everyone should be aware of that. It's not just disliking someone because of the color of their skin. There are systems in place in healthcare and the justice system that, you know, are automatically formed to put people of color at the bottom and keep them at the bottom of the barrel. So I thought that the dictionary definition should represent that, you know, to avoid misinforming the masses.
Mm-hmm. This all started when you shared a post on Facebook about how microaggression is a form of racism. I understand that you received responses from your friends. What were they saying to you?
Yes, they were basically just saying, like, do you understand the definition of racism? Because that's actually not racism. Someone, those words, they don't mean anything. They're just words. That's not okay. That it may not be as blatant as you want it to be. It may not be, you know, a note with the N-word, but it still hurts.
Yeah, what you're saying there is that that is a microaggression, which is a form of racism when someone is questioning your ability.
Right, exactly. And that's something that, especially being surrounded by a lot of white bodies in college, that's something that I've gotten really accustomed to. It's not the blatant form. It's a lot of people questioning me or just not acknowledging my presence just because I am an African-American woman. So that is racism in itself. So that's kind of something that I thought the dictionary should be able to understand as well.
So you felt that this definition wasn't telling the whole story. What happened next? How did you get the dictionary to revise this definition?
I just sent out a request through email, and I just stated my claims that it's really misinforming the masses if you guys don't mention the systematic elements of racism and the role that it plays in everyday life. So you guys should really mention that in the definition. And so they got back to me fairly quickly, which I really did like. An editor reached out and we just had some conversations back and forth, and their main claim and what was holding them back was just because they said that they focused on the majority and how they use the word in literature and different things. But I kept questioning that because the minority, they're the ones who, you know, experience this on a day-to-day basis. So why aren't you looking at minority literature, and why aren't you trying to understand different minorities and as they view the word, as they experience the word, as it's very active in their lives?
You sent them this letter. There was a back and forth. When did you send the letter, and how long did it take until there was a resolution?
So I sent the letter May 28th, and then I got a resolution June 4th.
Not everyone is happy with this change. What's been the reaction?
Yeah, a lot of people have been saying, like, you can't change the dictionary to fit your narrative. But I think that the problem is that it's not a narrative. This has been happening to people of color. We've not just experienced, you know, the overt racism for years now. We've been experiencing all different types. Those people really just aren't understanding the history behind this. Obviously, a lot of the people who are angry, they just want to be ignorant and they want to stay stagnant. I thought maybe the dictionary changing would, you know, give them a little kick in the butt to try to change and understand as well.
Kennedy, you studied law, politics, and society, and you have a minor in journalism and public relations from Drake University. What's your takeaway from this experience?
I think it's very important to keep trying for your voice to be heard, especially a lot of people in my generation. They just think, you know, okay, we see our parents who still may be struggling because of the way that the systems are often harder for us to break through, but don't let that discourage you. So I think that my whole takeaway is just to really use your voice, find your voice, use your skills in order to make a difference.
That's Kennedy Mitchum. She's a recent graduate of Drake University who asked Merriam-Webster Dictionary to update its definition of racism. And they said yes. Kennedy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Worldwide protests against police brutality are shaking up the entertainment industry. The Paramount Network canceled the long-running reality TV show Cops earlier this week. And then the A&E Network followed suit, canceling its hit show Live PD. Let's bring in NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. And Eric, what do you think? Did these networks make the right call?
Yeah, I actually think they did. I've been a critic of Cops for quite a long time. Cops, of course, is a show that has aired for 30 years. It was put together by embedding camera crews with police officers who answer emergency calls and arrest people. And there's always been this criticism that not only do the police departments have a lot of control over what gets filmed, but there's some question about whether the people arrested feel like they fully have the independence to say that they won't sign a release. And there's also been these allegations that officers may feel pressure to arrest people or to do things that are exciting for the cameras because they want to end up on television. And so this idea that you're getting this look at policing that's authentic and real is not necessarily true, because the producers seem to get involved in trying to create situations that are different than what police departments might normally do.
And as you say, controversial really from the beginning. Here's a moment from a 2010 episode. Two officers in Florida have just pulled over a car that didn't use a turn signal. The cops are white, and the men in the car are black. Let's listen.
Don't move. There's a gun under the front seat. Don't move. Whatever you do, don't move. You take him out, and then I'll take this one. There's a revolver right under the front seat. Keep your hands up. Put him up.
Get on the ground right now. Get it down.
You reach down, and I'm going to put one right here.
So Eric, seems like that disgusted critics of the show for years, but frankly, also seems like that is, you know, probably what drew so many people in. Why was it so popular for so long?
Well, you know, it was seemingly a real life version of the kind of cop drama that we've grown up seeing fictionalized on TV for a long time. And so there was this sense that you were sort of getting a peek at how it actually goes down. And of course, because they were manipulating the stories, they were able to actually deliver stories. And most of the time they show the cops exercising the best judgment. You know, when they pull a black person over or anybody over, you know, in the world of Cops, when they pull them over, they find out that they have a gun or they have drugs or something like that. You don't see the instances when they pull somebody over for something like that and it turns out that they didn't really do anything wrong.
Right. And there's also the newest iteration of Cops, which is Live PD on A&E, which is, as we said, now canceled. And instead of showing the edited footage like Cops did, it actually broadcasts live footage from several embedded crews in different positions around the country. It was the network's most popular series. And Eric, when you take both of these shows together, it sounds like you're saying that they actually influenced the way that the public views police. And it was almost always in the police's favor.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, there's so much to talk about here. Live PD, I just want to point out, is a separate show. And their idea was to do what Cops does, but broadcasting live. Now, there's a ton of problems with this. Number one, if police officers show up to an emergency call at your house with cameras rolling, and they're feeding live to a show that's being broadcast nationwide, I don't think that you really have much of a chance as the victim or the subject of this attention to say that you don't want to be on national television. Also, the police departments have veto power. The officers on the scene can decide that they don't want anything to be shown, and they can tell the camera crew to stop filming at any point. So it's obvious that the producers have pitched the show to police departments to get their cooperation by telling them that the show's going to make them look good. And, of course, when you see that day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, of course that's going to have an impression on viewers.
Yeah. Before I let you go, we also saw this week that HBO Max pulled the 1939 Civil War classic Gone with the Wind for its problematic depiction, and we've known this for a long time, of the Civil War and slavery. HBO says it's going to bring it back eventually with more context. But, you know, take that and what we've been talking about with these cop shows and just reflect for a minute on what all this says about how the moment we're in is affecting the industry.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I love the idea of looking back at old movies and TV shows with fresh eyes and deciding, hey, you know, before someone consumes this, let's tell them a little bit about some of the problematic imagery in it. And so all these claims of censorship that some people have or this uproar, what I think it's really about is that it's unsettling to people to realize that a movie that they may have liked for a long time had messaging inside of it that they didn't realize was racist. But, you know, part of this moment is having the strength to be honest and face up to things that you may have accepted that now you may realize you shouldn't have accepted.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And let's stay with TV for just a moment longer. Comedian Dave Chappelle's latest special dropped on Netflix's YouTube channel last night. It's called 846, a reference to the death of George Floyd at the hands of police.
What are you signifying? That you can kneel on a man's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds and feel like you wouldn't get the wrath of God? That's what is happening right now.
And this is getting quite a bit of reaction online. So let's bring in Femi Okay. She's host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. And Femi, we bring you in on Fridays for a social media roundup. So what are you seeing in response to Dave Chappelle?
Oh, this trended immediately. Immediately it came out. It was a surprise release on Netflix and YouTube. It is free. You do not have to subscribe to anything in order to watch it. And the audience lapped it up. And why are people talking? Well, it's really because Dave Chappelle, he's more than a comedian. He's a commentator. For instance, let me give you some instant feedback here from Joel Leon. Joel says that Dave Chappelle's stand-up ain't even a stand-up. It's a history lesson. A Mark Dice coming from the other side. I know he's not a Chappelle fan, but he watched the whole special nevertheless. He says there wasn't even a joke for at least 7 minutes, hardly any in the 13 minutes, just him ranting about the police. But you can actually see this. You can see this for yourself, and then you can decide. But there's a lot of commentary and a lot of love coming from Dave Chappelle for speaking out right now.
I'm glad you said that some people didn't think it was funny, because even Chappelle acknowledged at one point that this production was not humorous.
He was making jokes about his jokes not being funny. It's like, I can't make jokes right now. Then people laughed about that.
But he was criticized by some fans for not speaking out sooner. I don't know, you know, whether you think that's fair or not, who knows. But did he address that?
He did. He absolutely did. He mentioned a certain CNN host for calling celebrities out. And Chappelle said, you know, I have been talking about police violence for years. And what
Don
is happening
Lemon
right
you're
now?
Referring
to. Yes. You named him. So he talked about Don Lemon on CNN. And he said, I have been talking about police brutality for years. What is happening in America right now is grassroots anti-racism movement. Nobody wants to see or hear from celebrities. The young protesters are doing a great job. Carry on.
Quickly, let's touch on another very interesting story this week. NASCAR is getting ready for another race on Sunday. It's going to be in Miami, and it's going to also be the first NASCAR event with fans in the stands since mid-March. Now, the context here is that the sport banned the Confederate flag from races. And we talked about the significance of this yesterday on the show. But tell us, now that people have had a chance to weigh in on this, what are fans saying?
What I noticed was really interesting online was new NASCAR fan, Sarah Fong, Black Lives Matter. She says, not only did NASCAR ban all the Confederate flag-related content at their venue, they also made a message for pride. They have a Black Lives Matter car for Bubba Wallace. He's the only black driver in NASCAR. I'm not going to sleep tonight. I'm just going to be reading Twitter comments and becoming a new NASCAR fan. And some fans are just saying there's too much politics in NASCAR. Why can't we just race and have fun?
Huh. On another topic, I know you're following the fallout surrounding Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling's controversial views about transgender identity. You're going to have to remind us what's behind all of this and first of all, why it's back in the news.
So J.K. Rowling has, over a period of time, talked about trans and the ways different genders and sexes work from her perspective. And any time that she's liked or she's commented, she's got a lot of pushback that she's not supporting the trans community. Rowling has said that, I respect every trans person's right. She's done this on Twitter. She's really big on Twitter to live any way that feels authentic and comfortable to them. But her life has been shaped by being female. There's been so much back and forth that she actually went to her website and wrote a very long essay about her perspective on trans and gender on her own website. And then let me give you some of the pushback here from Tess Fowler, for instance. She says, do not read J.K. Rowling's transphobia manifesto. I already did it for you. Every line is misinformation. And then also, Rowling is getting a lot of support saying, thank you, I am a feminist. I really appreciate your take. So even though J.K. Rowling has written this entire essay, she's posted it out there so everybody can see, it hasn't stopped that debate where people have called her a transphobe and not supporting the trans community. So that goes on and on.
Interesting to see that some of the stars from Harry Potter have called her out for this. But, you know, we're going to have to save that for another time because we are out of time. Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thanks so much, as always.
You're welcome. Take care, Peter.
You too.
Protests over racial injustice are spreading across the country while a pandemic continues to take its toll. The next weeks and months are leading to a consequential election this November. And every day, the NPR Politics podcast is here to discuss how it could reshape your world.
The markets are beginning to regain ground today after taking a sudden nosedive Thursday. The S&P 500 dropped 5.9% Thursday as investors absorbed the news that the U.S. economy may not reopen as fast as they'd hoped. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. And Mike, the markets seemed as if they were speeding along with the S&P 500 turning positive on Monday. Then they hit this road bump yesterday. Tell us more.
Well, Tanya, as you say, they really were speeding along. The gains were very rapid since those lows in March. And that really caused a lot of people to start to worry that they had gotten, the stock market had gotten ahead of itself and that the valuations were almost approaching sort of bubble-like levels. And if not bubble, at least pricing in a very optimistic scenario about the rebound in the economy. So on Tuesday and Wednesday, we saw the markets start to slip. They dropped about 1.5-2% for the S&P and the Dow Jones over those 2 days. And then it really snowballed on Thursday. And sort of along with all of that worry about the market were a lot of news reports suggesting that the virus spread is accelerating in some parts of the country. So really caused investors to rethink this optimistic assumption about the rebound in the economy.
Some of the hardest hit stocks were Bank of America, which dropped 10%. Caterpillar, the machinery and equipment company, that stock fell 8.3%. Boeing, 16%. What does this picture tell us?
All right. So if you look at those really economically sensitive stocks like that, along with, say, the cruise ship operators and the airlines, which were also among the biggest decliners, it really does kind of back up that notion that there's been a rethink about the virus and the potential for it to accelerate a little bit further in coming months and cause sort of, if not the drastic situations of lockdowns that we've seen in the past months, at least not quite that really rosy, optimistic rebound of the economy that everyone was hoping for.
Okay, so unemployment is still a little above 16%. The economy is expected to contract around 6% before the year's over. I want to ask you, do you see this as the market really being out of touch with reality, or is it a reaction to something else?
Well, certainly certain pockets of the market are pretty much detached from reality. You know, there's stocks of companies in bankruptcy protection that rallied hundreds of percent over a few days. But if you look at the market as a whole, I think it does appear detached from that perspective of the economy, as you mentioned. But the other dimension of it all is this massive stimulus being put into the economy from the federal government and the Federal Reserve, you know, trillions of dollars of money flowing into the real economy and to financial markets. So it makes it very difficult for investors to sort of reconcile the two and come up with a fair valuation for the market when there are these two sort of competing forces going on at once. It's really uncharted territory for investors, so it kind of explains why it's difficult and why the market is up big one day and down a lot the next day. Is there's a lot of debate about what the valuation of the market really should be in this environment.
Mm-hmm. That's Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tony.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown has paused her state's reopening plans by 1 week as coronavirus cases there reached a new 7-day high. Oregon is one of at least 7 states seeing an uptick in COVID-19 cases as much of the country relaxes lockdown measures. Still, as people return slowly to normal life, many are wondering which everyday activities are safe to resume and what might be too risky. Let's ask Mercedes Carnathan. She's a professor of epidemiology at Northwestern University. And Mercedes, many of us want to get together with friends and family after months of staying apart. What is the best way to do that? And is it okay if it's outside and there's no physical contact?
Yes. You know, I think one of the best ways to think about it is an emphasis on the term physical distancing rather than social distancing. As you point out, gatherings that take place outside where there's fresh air circulation and plenty of space are considered somewhat safer than gatherings that are inside in enclosed rooms. And even when we're outside with our friends and our loved ones, this isn't the time, unfortunately, to run up and give a big hug, even though we're so happy to see one another after such a long shut-in period. If we're able to maintain these freedoms and be able to be outside and see our friends, we have to respect certain parameters that require physical distancing. And that includes, where possible, wearing face masks so that we have the pleasure of at least speaking face to face with someone, but not sharing respiratory droplets, which we know to be the most common way that the virus is transmitted between individuals.
You mentioned small gatherings. Does it matter the size of the gathering if it's fewer than 10 people or if it's a huge gathering in someone's backyard?
Right now, current recommendations in many states, including the state where I am in, requests gatherings of 10 people or less. And why that number is important is in part due to space. And then there's the statistical reason. If we think that, say, for example, in a given area at a given time, there's a 5% prevalence of COVID-19 in the community, that would mean that in a group of 100, theoretically, there could be 5 infected people. If you cut that group down to 10 people, your likelihood of running into those 5 infected people goes down tenfold. So part of it is purely a numbers game. If 2 out of 100 are infected, your probability of finding those 2 is greater in a larger group.
Well, Mercedes, this makes me think, though, about flying. I mean, people are doing it, but when do you think it will be safe to travel again?
You know, the question of safety is really one of risk. So there are risks every time you step outside your door. There are very good reasons why somebody has to fly on an airplane, and they should take all of the precautions they can to lower their risk. And that includes wearing personal protective equipment and maintaining the utmost hygiene, cleaning the space that you're in, limiting your interaction with people to the extent that you can. You know, I think it's just an issue of knowing what your priorities are. What are you flying to go do? You know, are you getting on an airplane to then go visit a potentially vulnerable friend or relative? That might be a decision that where the risk outweighs the reward.
Yeah. You know, there was a congressional hearing just this week looking at what the fall might look like for school children. Mm-hmm. Do you think it will be advisable for kids to go back to school? I know it's a $1 million question, but it's one that all want answers to.
Yes, I have school-aged children myself, aged 5 and 7. And so I'm certainly eager to see how we can mitigate the risks while experiencing what we know to be the benefits of an educational setting. And so, unfortunately, the questions about safety of opening schools really are very individual. They are individual at the community level, depending on what the background burden of COVID-19 is in a given community. For example, opening a school in an area where the overall prevalence looks to be very low, less than 1%, mm-hmm. is a very different scenario than opening it where there are estimates of 10% of the community being exposed already to COVID. So these are difficult decisions that don't come without risk. And I think those decisions need to really be carefully weighed against the potential downsides from a social perspective of keeping children out of school, and who is likely to be harmed the most by those decisions to continue to keep children out of school, and who is likely to be harmed by the decisions to send children to school.
I want to ask you about masks. So we're reading about health officials in Switzerland not recommending their citizens wear masks, saying that they promote a false sense of security and might actually encourage people to then engage in riskier behavior. Is there any truth to that?
That's an interesting point to consider. Our current recommendations here in the United States are for individuals to wear masks in settings in which they are unable to socially or physically distance themselves. In my opinion, I see less risk to wearing masks than the risk of not wearing masks. To me, I think the false sense of security may come into when you consider how vulnerable an individual is. So somebody with a lot of risk factors or characteristics that we see as associated with worse outcomes from COVID, they may decide that wearing a mask is not going to be adequate protection. And for that individual, the risk may outweigh the benefit of being able to interact in public.
I went to an appointment this week. Okay, so I'm going to divulge something personal here. I went to get my hair done, Mercedes. I had to get color.
No,
I had to get it colored.
That.
Right, but everyone wore a mask. And as I was driving home, I was thinking about the risk that I had just taken. But then I thought about the fact that I could go get a test right away if I wanted to. And I was wondering if that is a mechanism for us curbing the spread, making certain if we are in situations where we believe it's been risky, if we take those steps, could we mitigate it in that way?
You know, I like your line of thought there. I think the benefit of testing is so that we know what the burden of disease is in a given community. All we know right now is the tip of the iceberg, because only people with symptoms are being tested, and mm-hmm. we're counting people who end up in the hospital or have terrible outcomes. If we find out through random testing, and that's really what we need, that tells us a lot about what the background risk is of community transmission. But to get your hair done in a state where it appears that there have been 1,000 cases total over the course of 3 months is certainly a lower risk scenario than having your hair done in a state where there have been 200,000 cases, because your likelihood, again, of running into an individual who has the disease is much higher in a state and an area where there's a higher burden of disease.
Do you think these basic precautions, like we've been talking about, are enough? Are you confident we won't see a surge in cases as states reopen, as long as people wear masks and self-quarantine if they're sick?
If I had the answer to that question, I believe I would be on stage receiving an award.
That's right.
I will say that what our data are showing us right now as states are reopening is that we are seeing increases in the transmission of COVID-19. What we don't know is whether or not those new individuals who are being infected are taking precautions such as wearing masks. And I will say, as I consider my hopefulness for this, is that we will find that the proper use of personal protective equipment by a large portion of the population will slow the transmission of COVID-19, because this disease is not going to go away quickly, and we all feel an urgency to return to some semblance of normal, although we are going to be in a post-COVID normal. And perhaps that post-COVID normal is just going to need to be masks so that we can keep the transmission levels low and not overburden our hospital system.
That's Mercedes Carnathan. She's a professor of epidemiology and vice chair of the Department of Preventative Medicine at Northwestern University. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The death of George Floyd is sparking protests around the globe, including in countries across Africa. Dozens recently gathered in Ghana.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
Many more took to the streets in Kenya.
We want justice! We want justice!
These protests are not only showing solidarity with Black Americans, but also calling for the end of police brutality across the continent. Joining us now is Moki Makura, a Nigerian based in Johannesburg, South Africa. She's also executive director of Africa No Filter. It's a nonprofit working to shift harmful narratives about the continent. And Moki, are you surprised at how much the Black Lives Matter movement has resonated there in Africa?
You know, I think it's been surprising how much it has. And I think a lot of it is to do, particularly in South Africa, is that we have got in South Africa a history of racism. So I think that's one area. But I think in other countries where we don't have that same clear dichotomy of black and white and racism, it's been phenomenal how much it has resonated. And I think one of the things that struck me is that the age group of the people that it's resonated with, you know, these are Gen Zs or, you know, just teenagers and early 20s that just seem to have really kind of gotten behind this movement that feels a little bit far away from them. And that's kind of surprised me.
Can you talk more about that? Because as you rightly point out, much of the continent doesn't have the same experience with racism that we do here in the United States, or the history of apartheid that you see there where you are in South Africa. Tell me more about that distinction and why it's worth making.
Well, I mean, the fact that I feel that, you know, people don't have that history of racism or the legacy of racism, I think what we do have on the continent is colonialism. And in both cases, with the racism and with colonialism, it's the white perpetrator and the black victim. So I feel there's a lot of, you know, empathy with the situation our American brothers are experiencing now. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why it resonates. But I feel that the reason why it's such a compelling movement is that it's so simplistic in a way. The message is so clear. The visuals were just so powerful. And also the timing for it was critical. I think people have just got a lot more time to be on social media.
Are you talking about because they're locked at home for the coronavirus?
Yes. I think people are just spending a lot more time. And, you know, I think that particular generation, they are not doing that much. So it's a lot of it is now happening on social media. Along comes this campaign. You know, it just was just one of these things. We wanted to get engaged, want to be part of it.
Well, and I point that out because there have been other recent moments of solidarity with Black Americans in Africa. Back in 2016, protesters were gathered outside the U.S. consulate in Cape Town after two Americans, Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, were killed by the police. But you're saying this moment feels different.
Well, I think it does feel different. I feel that people feel they're part of a global movement. It's not an American movement, even though I've seen it as one, because I think the issues which sort of triggered it, which, you know, around police brutality, you know, particularly around black people, I think that was an American issue. But somehow this thing has taken off and it's about, you know, black and white. That's what's coming through. So even in, particularly in South Africa, what you're seeing is you're having these young people are having conversations around racism in a way that is just a lot more stronger. You know, like, I think black people here seem to have more agency. This Black Lives Matter has empowered them to ask tougher questions because there's a movement behind them. Schools are suffering now, you know, private schools where black and white kids are there. So it just seems a lot bigger, and it's giving people the idea that they have agency to equally create movements like this.
Yeah, the head of the African Union swiftly condemned the murder of George Floyd, and it called for the U.S. to intensify its efforts to ensure the total elimination of all forms of discrimination based on race. You have called this statement ironic. Why is that?
It is ironic because right on our doorstep, there are so many examples of injustice. It's strange that, you know, the African Union, which represents all 55 countries on the continent, chooses to turn its back and not do a similar sort of issue, a similar statement when there are things happening right on our doorstep. And they send a statement to America. Why? It's ironic because why would you do that and not do something similar for every single time we've had the example of a George Floyd that's died from anything, from ethnicity, from gender? There's a huge gender-based violence protest, you know, going on, well, in Nigeria, but also a little bit in South Africa, where a woman was found murdered. In Nigeria, three girls were murdered. So how come white on black injustice somehow is more elevated, and the AU sees that they should respond to it, but they don't when the equivalent happens in Africa?
That's Moki Makura. She's executive director of Africa No Filter. It's a nonprofit working to shift harmful narratives about the continent. Moki, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.